Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and on this week's episodes, we talk Man City. What is wrong with the champions? You need hyper elite players, or you need magical tactics to continue to operate at world-class attacking level while weighting your personnel so heavily towards defending transitions. When they've got injuries, I don't think they can do it. When somebody's out of form, I don't think they can do it. When the teams in the league are improving, both in coaching and personnel, I don't think they can do it. Then we bring you the burn book. I love Patek Philippe, but they're fucking way more expensive.
You can pick them up on auction for about the same price. The thing is, I feel like when you buy a Rolex... Man,
you've been looking at late night auctions, haven't you?
I have. Bonhams in particular.
Well, over on the subscription side, we ask where Jadon Sancho can revive his career. If you think that you can, like, see it out, new manager comes in, maybe you get a shot, and maybe you can wangle a move to, like, Spurs or Juventus, which always gets rumoured, then so be it. But I just don't think that's on the cards. We talk over some of the big moves of January, and we discuss our perfect Christmas dinner on anything but football. That's all on this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So we are back. Obviously, we're a little bit late. I am essentially fully recovered from whatever was going on with me. Pete, my co-host, how are you, Pete?
Hello, hello. I just realised that in the 30 minutes that we spent talking before starting recording, I actually didn't once ask you how you were feeling after being on death's door apparently last week. So, you know, great friend
here. That
was
fine. Yeah, that was fine.
Glad you're feeling better.
You moved the podcast to a day when you are on death's door, but for different reasons, which is the act of a friend.
I'm a martyr, if anything. Selfless, as always. Yeah, I wouldn't say I'm on death's door. I'm just running on empty. If I was a car, the petrol light would very much be on. So we're now at, 8 p.m.-ish, just before Wednesday, 20th of December. My alarm clock went off at 4:30 this morning to get a 7 a.m. flight, which always seems like a good idea until you actually have to get the flight. And I suppose if maybe normal people can go to sleep at like an appropriate time, knowing they have to get up really early. But like, I think I went to bed at like 1 last night. I think I went to bed at 12:15, but was still awake at like 1:15, just thinking about the fact that I needed to get up at 4:30.
Of course, yeah.
And then I presume I fell asleep sometime between 1:30 and 2. So I got like 2.5 hours sleep, maybe. Took like an hour cat nap. But yeah, I'm early flight this morning, then worked the full day. Now I'm here. And I'm actually kind of in a good mood, though, because I've started drinking the beer. Although the first beer I opened, you did witness it, spilled everywhere in this. I'm currently in my childhood bedroom, which is
really
where it's now redesigned to be a guest room.
It doesn't look very Pete Dorman-y.
It absolutely is. Well, I mean, it's a lovely guest room, but it's the four walls that housed my childhood. Although it's not the aesthetic or the furniture is all changed, but it's not an overly big room, so the smell in this room over the next few days will probably be quite strong of stale beer, but it's
fine. But that was going to happen anyway, right?
Well, just because of the 3 hours that we're going to spend here, or just me in general, you know, such a hockey lad I am.
Yeah, the behavior that I assume you indulge in over Christmas, I imagine, is you just like sweating beer fumes for like a week.
I was just about to like dig you out about firstly misquoting your wife. He messaged me on the side.
She was so mad.
Being like, just to put it straight, by the way, I never said that I forget that you're intelligent. And she went on to say what she actually said, which was something completely different and really quite nice. But also I give her, you and her, a pass for calling me a hockey lad, because it is kind of true. And I kind of went in there digging out a bit, but I've just realized that the only reason I'm home currently for 4 days, I'm flying back to London on Christmas Eve. The only reason I'm home is for a hockey dinner.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So the irony was actually lost on me there for a second until this moment of clarity.
Yeah. I mean, Emma did have quite strong words with me.
Yeah.
Where she was like, you've implied that I've been like talking shit about Pete, and I was just like, weren't you?
Yeah. Are we not meant to tell him that?
Yeah, I was just like, I thought that was what was funny about it. But okay, but yeah, she was furious about it. All right. I'm yet to go anywhere. I'm heading off to my my in-laws on Friday, but it's one of those things where, you know, between now and then, I've got about 72 hours worth of stuff to do in like 36 hours.
Oh, that's not good.
But it's fine. It's fine. Then it's Christmas. Then it's a wedding that I'm officiating. And then it's like 4 weeks till my second child arrives. So it should be great.
Really relaxing time for all, right?
Yeah, we need to figure out what's going to happen to the podcast then as well, because like we're going to have a third host of the podcast, which is going to be like my day old daughter, I guess.
Sure. Mm. Anything's better than Olivia Dodd.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, they're very similar, really.
Yeah, well, I imagine your daughter will be more intelligent, contribute more to society immediately.
Gee, you'd hope so. But I mean, like, but she's also going to be like, you know, kind of Southwest London girl, like, which is what Olivia Dodd is at heart, but probably similar height from day one, I would say. All right. So today, we were planning last week to talk about what was wrong with Manchester City. And fortunately, this weekend, I'd say things got considerably worse with Man City. Because when we were talking about it, it was from the beginning of the season, Opta had them at about a 90% chance of winning the league, which is kind of crazy when you consider how good some of the other teams in the league are. You know, especially Arsenal had a great half season last year. Newcastle, I think, have been better this year than anyone expected. And they're not really close to the title race, which is crazy. But anyway, they're at 90%. Last week, they'd kind of dropped to more like the 50 range. Now they're under 40%. So they're at 39% to win the league in Opta's latest predictions. Arsenal are now up to 30%. Liverpool are up to 24%. But in lots of other metrics, I saw one today that had Arsenal top, then Liverpool, then City. And I thought, I don't think I've ever seen that before. You know, where City are as low as third in probability to win the title. But essentially, those three teams are fairly evenly split in across most kind of prediction measures. And basically, all the models are agreed, though, even though they differ on percentage, they're all pretty much agreed that right now, a team other than City is more likely to win the league than Manchester City. So, Pete, I mean, it's quite shocking to be where we are at this stage of the season, even though I did see a thing today that said last three seasons, I think after 15 games or something, City were only top in one of them. But they're 5 points back this time. And as we'll get onto in a bit, they're not 5 points back and looking like the best team. They're 5 points back and looking like one of three good teams.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting considering 6 months ago, about 6 months ago, City's ridiculous dominance in all competitions, in every competition they touched, they were just absolutely by far and away the best team in Europe and in the world. And fast forward to now, and that's kind of been flipped on its head. And this is the first time in a long time where you look at City, and sure, okay, previous seasons they've started kind of slow. Last season they started kind of slow. They were playing pretty ugly, pretty not bad football, but certainly worse than that team would have expected to play. And then come February, they just kicked into overdrive and just ran away with everything.
Mm.
So I can understand people making arguments and comparing that to this season so far, but it feels different and the scenarios feel different. And you watch City play, and last season it felt like they weren't far off being amazing. It was just things weren't really clicking. This season, it feels like they're not a million miles off being, like, they can very easily win the league. Like, this is how good City are and how big their squad is. But it feels like the issues they have this season are harder to fix than just certain players hitting a little bit more form and a little bit more cohesion. In the same season as Arsenal, or better than they were last, obviously they're not running as hot as they were last season, but as an entity, in terms of a whole season, I think they're better than they were last season.
Yeah, probably.
As in terms of their likelihood of being able to go a full 38-game season and win the Premier League. Okay,
They're deeper.
Yeah, they were incredible at the first half of last season, but everybody expected them to tail off at one point, and they did.
Mm.
I feel they're in a better position this season. I feel Liverpool, while they still have some issues, are in a better position this season. And if they fill a couple of holes with some smart moves into January, if they're planning on that, they could be really, really dangerous deep into the season as well. And everything's kind of set up that the narrative over the past however many years has always been City are going to win the title, who's going to finish second and blue. And this season, it definitely was that coming into it. 90% Opta predicted them to win the title in a really competitive Premier League as well. Like, that's mental. That is crazy. That's like Bayern levels of dominance in terms of like league predictions. But now, you know, we're barely at Christmas. We're late December. It really feels like it's a genuine title race. And I don't think, other than, the two with Liverpool where they went, 97, 98 points and then the Centurion season.
Yeah.
This feels like it could be a proper title race, which we haven't had in a few seasons. And I don't remember the last time we had a multi-team title race as well. Where three teams could genuinely win it.
Yeah, that's the thing. Right now, if you look at the expected goal difference per 90, which as people who listen to the podcast will know, is kind of like our, if we're asked to look at it through one number, this is the one number we use to kind of measure team quality. Their expected goal difference per 90 is still plus 0.9. That's really, really good.
Yeah.
But Arsenal are at plus 1.1. So that's a 0.2 difference. That's a really big difference. Liverpool are at plus 0.8. So City are closer to Liverpool in third in team quality right now than they are to Arsenal in first. Now, maybe Arsenal are just like clearly better than City and Liverpool and walk away with things. My instinct says that's probably not true. But when you're 5 points back on a team that has significantly better metrics than you currently, that is a concern. And I mean, look, it's taken a lot of bad results to get here. So last six games in the league, 4 draws, 1 loss, and only 1 win. That's what it's taken for them to drop under 50% probability for the title. And I'd put in the script here some stats that I got from Understat, the expected goals of some of those games. But actually, you've put in the stats from FBref, and I would say that they are much more troubling reading for City. Because I'd have said that the Liverpool performance, City were still clearly the better side. The Tottenham performance, obviously the better side. Luton Town, I mean, is what you expect. Yeah. But looking at these results and these expected goals for and against, Chelsea game, dead even, 2.94, 2.9 against. And 2.9 XG against City is almost unheard of. But three games later, 2.3 XG against them, against Villa. And they only put up 0.6 themselves. Two games after that, they put up 1.6 XG against Palace and gave up 1.8 to Palace at the Etihad, which is absolutely staggering. I mean, look, the Spurs game, that should have been a solid win for them. They were far better in that game. Luton Town, far better. Liverpool, they were the better side, but here it's 1.3 to 0.6. I mean,
not that big a difference.
You round one down, you round one up. Yeah. Like, that's perfectly in the realm of 1-1. Like, I mean, and as for some of the performances in these games, the Villa game in particular is potentially the worst performance I've seen from a Pep Guardiola team.
Ooh, punchy. Maybe ever,
but one of their worst ones. Maybe one of his worst at Man City. Like, Villa, don't get me wrong, like, Villa had just a great game. Like, everyone was on it. They played super, super well. But City had two shots and they were both from the same phase of play. So if they'd scored the first shot, they wouldn't have had the second shot.
Yeah.
And both of those shots were in the 10th minute. And after that, they failed to have a shot for over 80 minutes, even when they went behind. And they gave up 22 shots. That's absolutely staggering. And yeah, people will say, well, Arsenal lost at Villa Park as well. But Arsenal outshot Villa 12-10. And on XG, it was 1.7 to Arsenal, 0.6 to Villa. So, you know, I'm not necessarily saying like Arsenal deserved to win that game. Like, Villa scored a really good goal in that match and Arsenal didn't finish chances.
Yeah.
But Arsenal played that game the way you'd expect a team trying to win the title would play away at a really tough side. Yeah. And they were better. Whereas City played away at Villa like a mid-table team would. They just got battered by Villa.
You look at the Arsenal result and you think, okay, that's just a result that happens. Sometimes that just happens. That's football. But you can kind of go away from that being like, we kind of played how we planned to play and it just didn't work out. There's nothing majorly wrong there. Underlying numbers of that Villa game against City, mental. Like, City miles off it. And the Palace game even the other week, like, they generated 1.6 XG from 74% possession at home against Palace.
Yeah, that's crazy.
It's just outrageous. And you said there that, like, getting over, what, 2xG against City is mad. In that six games, they've conceded 12. Like, they've conceded two goals on average in those six games that they've taken one win, three draws and a loss. And for everything about City at the minute, compared to last year, compared to previous seasons, they just look way more vulnerable, particularly to the counter-attack, but just way more vulnerable generally. It just seems less structured. They've got less control. And there could be a lot of reasons for this, and we will go into them. But just top line of everything, you watched them play over the past month or so, and everything just seems more chaotic and less cultured than it's ever been, or than I remember it being.
Yeah, I mean, it used to be with City that they were so much better than opponents that the margin for getting kind of footballed, you know, for like losing out on
luck.
They
just took that out.
Yeah, because you were like, if you're just twice as good as your opponents, if you put up, basically, you know, Arsenal put up 1.1 XG more than Villa, most of the time that's enough, but quite often it isn't.
Yeah.
If you put up like 3 XG more than your opponents or 2 XG more than your opponents, it's so unlikely that you'll lose that game.
Yeah, you need like 2 to 3 worldies a game.
Yeah.
To then start being a problem that we're dropping loads of points. It's like just the probability is just almost nil.
And now City are, but now that margin between City and their opponents has shrunk and it's been growing for other sides. I mean, Liverpool are nowhere near their peak, but this is the best Arsenal we've seen in 20 years.
Yeah.
And looking at the last couple of years, you know, like City's expected goal difference per 90, plus 0.9, like I said, very good. Last year it was plus 1.22. The year before it was plus 1.7. The year before that it was plus 1, and they were the best team in the league in all three of those seasons. Now they are second best, and as I say, closer to third than they are to first. Even in the year that Liverpool won the league, City's expected goal difference was plus 1.5, and Liverpool were at plus 0.8. And I would actually say, you know, that flatters City a little bit because Liverpool were able to take their foot off the gas and City were really chasing as the season went on. But we've basically never been in this position. As I said before, we've never been in the position where City have been behind and have been worse. So even last year, as you said, like Arsenal were so hot in the first half of that season that we were like, one, their performance level was so high that we were like, these guys can't perform at the 99th percentile for the whole season. That's one thing. They were also getting lucky in terms of how those performances were translating into points. To get 50 points over half season is bananas. During that period, City were quote unquote bad, and there were like multiple think pieces about whether they were better off without Haaland, whether they become more one dimensional. And yet, during that period, they were dead level with Arsenal on expected goal difference per 90. They were both at plus 1.3. So a City that was out of form, in inverted commas, that was adjusting to, you know, this new striker, that people were saying, what's wrong with Manchester City? They still took, didn't they take 45 points over the first half of that season? They were still on a 90-point pace when they were supposedly playing like shit. Yeah, I think they were 5 points behind Arsenal at the midpoint.
That's like the scary thing about City in that era. And I'm saying that era as if that era is done. And it isn't necessarily, but the way this has trended, it could indicate that maybe this is the beginning of the end. But that season, particularly last season, you looked at them and you're like, they are in third gear best, but they're still one of the best teams in the Premier League. Like in terms of underlying numbers, in terms of points per game, and everybody expected them to go on and win the league, and they did. And it's just frightening that the dominance that they've got, that they had at that point, was that they can play to the extent where people were questioning everything about their system. And yet, if you asked somebody who was writing that article, who would, if you had to put money on it, who would win the Premier League from this point? I would say 80% of them would have said City.
Yeah.
Which is fair.
Yeah, it was a slightly contrarian position to say Liverpool. And it was like a historically incredible Liverpool side, which would drop points 5 to 6 times a season and would compete for the reached multiple Champions League. What? They reached 3 Champions League finals in 4 or 5 years.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's just. But the thing is, you know, like, we're not talking about a decline in City. Like, they've gone from being like historically amazing to just like very, very good and the best side in the league. Mm-hmm. We're talking about a decline in City from treble winners to one of a number of contenders in the Premier League.
Within 6 months.
Which, again, we haven't really seen since that first season of Pep, where they were, I think by the numbers, they were still the best team in the league in the 2016-17 season, the season that Conte won the league with Chelsea. I think statistically, they were still the best side in the league. Obviously didn't win it, but this, I mean, if this were to last over the course of the campaign, it would be something we've essentially never seen before. Like, okay, so if you look at expected points for the 2016-17 season, according to Understat, they have Chelsea at 76 points. Chelsea ended up with 93. And they have Man City 10 points ahead at 85, and they ended up with 78. They had the best attack in the league by 10 expected goals. They had the second best defence in the league. They were one expected goal behind Chelsea. They were unbelievably good across that season. And
they finished 78 points.
And they finished third. Yeah. And they were, you know, 3 points away from finishing fifth. Well, right now, they're worse than that side. And I suppose we have to go into some of the reasons, but like, it's just staggering that when you look at the trend lines, you're like, 3 years ago or two seasons ago, 2.3 XG per 90. That's what their attack put up. 2.1 the next year, 1.9 this year. Two seasons ago, they allowed 0.65 expected goals per 90 minutes in defence, which is crazy. It went to 0.85 last year, and this year it's at 0.97. So, like, the attack and defence have both been getting worse.
Yeah.
They used to lead the league in passes into the penalty area. Last year they were third, yeah. Now they're fourth.
Look, I do, just doing the math there quickly in my head, that means literally their defence has gotten 30% worse and their attack has got 30% worse as well over two seasons, roughly.
I mean, their attack has got more like, you know, a little bit under 10% worse, right?
Oh, across, what was his first? What was
oh,
his
no, yeah,
season?
You're right. Yeah, from the 2.3, yeah.
So it's about,
no,
it's
you're
about
right, yeah.
20 to 30%, I think 20-something% in attack worse and 30% worse in defence over two seasons.
It's a really big decline. In other places as well, you know, like their shots per game, they used to be at 18.5 shots, now they're at 15.5. Still very good. Same number of shots as Arsenal, though their shots are further out than Arsenal's. But, you know, you've lost a sixth of your shots there in 2 years. Passes into the box, they were at like 14 2 years ago per 90. Now they're at 11.5. They're behind Spurs.
Mm. I think there's one very big reason for that, though, this season at least.
Sure. And I do think we have to talk about injuries, because not only have they had some significant injuries, though they're not the only ones. I think basically almost every team in the league can complain about injuries this year. You know, Liverpool have got Robertson out all season. United, Newcastle, Spurs, all absolutely decimated by injury. Arsenal lost Timber first game of the season. Jesus has still barely played. I mean, like, everybody's got these things to complain about.
And also, if any team you're least sympathetic for in terms of squad depth, it's probably City.
Well, especially because, as
we'll
come on to later...
Maybe Chelsea, because they're just stockpiling players.
Yeah, but sure, fuck them. Yeah. But, like, I'm not terribly sympathetic because, as we'll come on to in a bit, I don't really like City's squad construction.
Sure.
But, I don't know, do you want to run through the injuries? Because the injuries are... Basically, all their major players have missed significant minutes or are going to.
Well, yeah, basically, if you were to create a list, like a who's who list from like last season or the last two seasons for City, pretty much everybody on that list is currently injured or has been injured or has missed time. So obviously, De Bruyne is a big one. He, hamstring injury, out until at least the new year. And then even when he comes back, one, he needs to get fit, and two, he needs to stay fit. Which, again, we've no idea. One, at his age, and two, it's already come back once, isn't it? Like, he did it, and then he came back, and then he did it again.
Yeah.
So, no idea. He could come back, and he could be fine. But, again, there's a lot of grey area about that. And he, in this City dominance era, has been the guy for them. He's been that talismanic kind of creative force that has been a huge, or arguably the biggest part of their success in the last, like, 5-6 years. Haaland has missed a couple of games, and... While he missed, you know, Luton and Palace, which should have been like comfortable wins for City anyway, that's a little bit of a concern, because we spoke about it maybe last season, a player that explosive, a player that big, a player that plays the way he does. If he starts getting niggles and injuries regularly, that only goes one way. That doesn't get better. That only gets worse over time, just because of the pressure that his joints and his knees are having to cope with, and the way he runs, the way he plays, his size in general. So maybe this is just a short-term thing that isn't concerning. But if this happens a couple more times in the next two seasons or so, you start to think this guy might be done at 27.
And part of the issue, that was part of the thing with Jesus as well, because Jesus, Yeah, I know that people will say like, oh, not clinical, blah, blah, blah. There's always that kind of shit. But part of the issue with Jesus is that when Jesus is on the pitch, you get a guy who looks like an elite attacker. Like, he's an amazing part of making your attack fluid and scary. But you basically get fully fit Jesus 20 games a season. That was part of the issue. Yeah. And the team wasn't built around Jesus the way it's built around Haaland. Like, Haaland in that Villa game still got all the team's XG. He had both of those two shots.
Mm-hmm.
And so even in a game where City were bad, okay, by understats numbers, he got one XG by himself. By FBRFs, he got 0.6 XG. This is still really, really good. But it essentially shows you that if Haaland doesn't finish the chances, if Haaland's not getting the chances...
Where do they come from?
Nobody is. And again, we're going to come back to that later because, like, I really, really do quite strongly object to some of the squad construction choices that have been made in this team. But I mean, he could miss a bit, and like what is the
composition of City? How do they look? How do they play?
It's going to be Alvarez, supposedly the form player in the Premier League. Like, remember 6 weeks ago when everyone was like, Alvarez is the form player in the Premier League. And then 6 weeks later, they're like, oh, fuck, of course City are crap because Haaland's injured. It's like, well, continue telling me how Bernardo Silva is the best player in the Premier League and continue telling me how Alvarez is like the form player. And then also kind of deal with the fact that City are right now on the worst run of form any Pep Guardiola side has been on, arguably ever. Arguably ever. I have seen, I'd say, more bad performances from Man City in the last month than I'd seen in the last 10 years under Guardiola sides.
I would say that's probably fair. But also, outside of Haaland, it isn't just Haaland, though, as well, because obviously we mentioned De Bruyne. Sure. Outside of that, John Stones.
Which is quite major.
Yeah. Outside of that, John Stones, who I absolutely thought was one of the players of the season last year, in the way he kind of inverted into midfield, and was a huge reason in the back half of last season that City were so successful in that kind of run from February where they just went into hyperdrive. I think John Stones was one of the biggest reasons for that. He played the full game against Villa, but he played 19 minutes against Luton and has been out for, I think, a month in total already this season. Grealish also missed a month, and Rodri got, three, four game suspension, and all of those three games, City lost. So those are pretty much all of their biggest players from one of the most successful City season ever. And then add to that the fact you've lost to kind of stalwarts like Gundogan and Mahrez, who were super reliable in terms of like output or just performance, like their role in the team. It's kind of easy to see why this squad is a bit unstable, why this team's a bit unstable, why it's perhaps lacking identity or cohesion or control. It's, you know, struggling to... So, you know, like when you're missing a Rodri and a De Bruyne and you get 73% possession against Palace at home but only generate 1.4 XG or whatever it was, all of a sudden you think, okay, if you add those two players in, that goes from 1.4 to 3.5 and they win that game 2-3-0 or 2-3-1. What, obviously, De Bruyne's like attacking prowess, Rodri's kind of just defensive solidity makes him a lot less vulnerable to the attack, to the counter-attack. Yeah, like when you take out, three of the best players in the Premier League, De Bruyne, Haaland, Rodri, your team's going to get worse. So the concern is how long they're out for, and also the fact that they don't really necessarily have a contingency plan for whenever one or more of these guys is out. Like, who is their Rodri plan that is actually functional? What is their KDB plan for somebody who actually continues to generate anywhere near as much creation as him? What is their Haaland plan when he's not there? And these are the biggest issues that I have with City at the minute.
I'm more sympathetic with it, with Haaland and De Bruyne, than I am with the others. Because with Grealish, I think, Grealish is amazing. He's an amazing ball mover. They also signed an amazing ball mover in Jeremy Doku.
Yeah,
and I wouldn't
class.
Say he's as good, but they've still got Foden.
He just looks class, though. He's such an exciting player to watch. He's unbelievable.
They've got Doku, they've got Foden, they've got Silva. Like, I mean, are these guys not good enough? Is Alvarez good enough? Like, Rodri, they should have enough to cover for an absence of Rodri and Stones.
They should.
They were playing five centre-backs last season, and Stones was amazing, but he's not the only player in the world who could do that. And I actually do remember saying quite a lot at the time, when people were like, Stones has been the best player in the world or whatever, like the last 6 months or something. I remember saying at the time, it would not surprise me if next season Stones is in and out of the team. And yes, he's been injured, but he was actually fit the last couple of weeks and he played 19 minutes in two games. So he played 1 minute against Palace. He came on in the 101st minute when City were at 2-2. So,
and what's your reasoning for him though? Like, what's your reasoning for that prediction and why he's in and out of the team, or why he thought he'd be in and out of the team despite having such an amazing season last year?
Because Pep always does this shit. Because he always does. Also, because Stones has a pretty ropey injury record. But Pep has done this. Like, when Laporte was like his best defender, he did it. Like, Ruben Dias has been fairly consistent, but you know, like Nathan Ake was a backup player for a while, then became a regular. Probably will drop out at some point. It just has always happened with Pep Guardiola. Like, quite often a centre-back will be his best player, supposedly, and then next season he's like, I actually don't really fancy this guy. Like, maybe we'll move him on. And so, I don't know. I'm not saying he was going to do that with Stones, but I am just saying that, like, when people are like, well, obviously, the core of this team now is De Bruyne, Haaland, Rodri, Stones, I was like, we will see. We will see.
Yeah.
Because also, teams start to work stuff out. Like, teams aren't stupid. Like, teams do have to, you have to make adjustments as teams get used to playing against you, you know, with a particular system. And Pep hasn't, like, solved football. There's always a new tweak that can be made. I also just think they signed Mateo Kovacic in the summer and they signed Mateus Nunes. And I don't like Mateus Nunes. And I said he wasn't good enough. And I don't think he is good enough. It's almost like he's arrived and City have said, oh boy, this guy who Pep said was like one of the best players in the world has turned out to be like, you know,
average.
A middling Premier League player. Though it also wouldn't surprise me if in 18 months Pep is like, oh, I actually, you know, gave this guy some magic mushrooms and now he's like fucking incredible.
Sure.
Like, but they signed Mateo Kovacic, who was a starting player for one of the superior sides in the league when they won the Champions League. He was a really useful player for Real Madrid for years. He was a really useful player for Chelsea for years. And now Man City players are like, well, obviously, you know, we're not going to win games like when we're missing Rodri because all we've got is Mateo Kovacic. You're like, well, you guys were saying that Rico Lewis was an amazing talent. You guys were saying that Bernardo Silva can do a great job in central midfield. And you guys were saying that Mateo Kovacic was an amazing signing, as was I. Like, no offence, but that should be enough at least to get a win against teams like Palace.
Yeah.
Against, no offence, because they are good this season, but Villa. Like, these are games that, even if City can't win them, they should be able to put in performances that clearly deserve to win them.
Yeah.
And they haven't done that. So, yes, I am sympathetic because their injuries are literally like, you know, if Arsenal have had actually Martinelli, Jesus, Odegaard injured this season, but if they'd also had Rice and Saka injured.
All at the same time.
Yeah. If Villa had had Watkins, Diaby, Douglas Luiz, Matty Cash, you know, their best players, if they'd all been injured at the same time, they would not be anywhere near where they are.
Yeah.
This is what, like, that is just true. However, City have essentially infinite resources. City have made transfer moves specifically to build towards a certain kind of side they want to be.
Yeah.
If your plan is, well, Rodri will just play 38 games of the season every season, then I'm sorry, but your plan isn't very good. Like, that's not a good setup. So, I don't know, I'm not all that sympathetic. And I do think that this brings us on to the other thing, which is like how responsible Pep is. Because City have tried a lot of things in midfield when Rodri's been missing. They've used Bernardo Silva, Rico Lewis, Kovacic, Nunes, Stones, Akanji in midfield. But they've also played in different ways. You know, like Pep himself has said, we're playing much narrower. You know, like we want to kind of compress the pitch into tighter spaces. You know, that is something that we've done without Rodri because Rodri covers so much ground normally. And that has just been a failure. You know, like Pep's not an idiot. He will adjust. And I do think they'll probably get better. But last season, he was using five centre-backs and everyone was like, this is amazing. They've got an extra man in possession. They've got an extra man out of possession because John Stones is so good. But it also means you have one attacker fewer on the pitch. And if De Bruyne is injured, if Haaland's injured, if Grealish is injured, you can't really afford to have one attacker fewer because Foden's great, Doku's great, Alvarez is great. They are not otherworldly great like the guys they're replacing. They're just not. And also the press has not been as effective. So like TIFO, I was watching a TIFO video today, and they used a chart produced by Mark R. Stats on Twitter, and it showed opponent pass completion against Man City across the season, and it's been ticking up and up and up slowly. Teams complete more and more of their passes against City than they used to, which shows that either teams are getting better at building against City overall, or more likely, City's press is less effective than it was. And that's partially a function of personnel, but it could be any number of things. It could be like players aren't pressing as hard as they used to, you know, the same players. It could be that Pep is just like maybe not reading the situation clearly correctly. It might be that teams have developed new tricks in build-up, but whatever it is, it's easier. And I think if you look as well at these games, you know, that we were talking about before, these last six games, I was looking at the possession numbers in these, and yes, they had 74% of the ball against Palace and 65% of the ball against Luton. They then had 59% against Liverpool, but against Chelsea, 55%. Against Tottenham, at home, 55%. Against Villa, away, 54%. And City are normally a sort of 65% possession side, minimum 60%. So they're below average in all those games, and that shows that their opponents are better at possessing the ball against them, and that requires City to press harder. And slowly, I would say that over the last few years, City have built themselves into a side that kind of expects to have the ball. And in the Premier League now, almost every team, maybe not almost every team, but I would say more than half of the teams in the league are completely comfortable holding possession. Yeah. It's not like years ago where you would play, you know, a Jose Mourinho side who were competing for every big trophy, and they would say, we don't give a fuck about possession. Like, we don't care. Like, every team now, you play Brentford, Brentford can hold the ball.
Well, yeah,
they can do it all day.
They'll have various game plans for various game scenarios. Like, they'll be as comfortable, a lot of teams will be as comfortable out of possession as they will be in possession.
And yeah, Brentford, Brighton, even Burnley.
A team of that stature historically would not have been.
Yeah, like in the past, a team like Brentford, that kind of level, which is lower mid-table, would probably have expected to have, you know, sub 45% possession of the ball.
Yeah.
And now if you play against Brentford and you give them the opportunity to keep the ball, they'll do it. And they'll do it well. Like, they're not just like, oh, fuck, what do I do with this? Like, they're really good at it. And like Burnley are probably going to get relegated, and Burnley are a positive possession side.
Yeah.
So City's press actually needs to be better than it's ever been. They need to be better out of possession than they've ever been. And I would say that right now, they're not really. You know, they're not as good at pressing teams. Like, I don't think Haaland is a particularly good presser. I don't think Grealish is a particularly good presser. Now, that's not to say they can't be, but City sometimes might be torn between playing their better pressing players or playing their better players. And that's not a particularly comfortable position to be in. That's kind of like the Arsenal situation years ago, where you were like, well, we need to pay Mesut Ozil because he's the only guy who could create, he and Alexis Sanchez are the only guys who can create something out of nothing. But Ozil might not really give us anything else away from home. Ozil might not really be an asset, except in the very few, you know, the 5% of the game that he's on the ball. Yeah. That's a concern. I look at this, I just think, I wouldn't predict it firmly, because I just think Pep is too good a manager not to figure it out. But some of this does feel a little bit like chickens coming home to roost for City. They've built towards a certain style, and maybe the league has evolved in exactly the way to punish that style.
But I kind of think that the league will naturally evolve to punish that style, because that style has been of the team that has been so dominant for so long.
You know, that's true.
Like, they're the people that everybody's shooting at, the people that everybody's shooting for.
Is that true? I don't know. I think teams in the last few years have basically been like, Christ, you know, City
well,
just takes
like, it's just a throwaway. It's just like, if we get anything from it, it's fine. We're probably going to get 0 points from two games. Move on.
The last couple of years, if I was like a mid-table side, and okay, look at it this way. If you had Arsenal, Man United and City, like Saturday, Wednesday, Sunday, the City game would be the one that you'd fuck off.
Sure.
You'd be like, City are probably going to beat us. They take 6 points off us every season. But United and Arsenal, we can like give them a game.
That is true. But I think when City are on such a pedestal, they're more in the limelight. You look at what they're doing and how to... I think you deconstruct what they're doing more than you would a United. So like in terms of, other than when you just come up against City, like the your match prep for that week, you might just prep against United for that. But I think City, it's more, what are they doing good and what are they doing bad, and how do we either emulate it or combat it, just kind of like longer term. So I think maybe that is part of the reason why teams have just gotten better at playing against City. But also, while they've been, their press has been worse, I do also think they've been considerably worse on the ball in possession this season as well, which will lend itself to being a part of the reason for a decline in like possession numbers. Because we've spoken about the injuries, and I don't want to backtrack on all of that, but when you look at that squad, I don't think there's a huge amount of players in a possession-based team that are able to absolutely run a game. Mm-hmm. Outside of De Bruyne, I think Rodri can do it in the way that he, in the kind of a, his skill set way. Bernardo probably as well, but I think even Foden seems a bit immature. It seems like maybe he could do it in a few years.
So who's going to like take charge of the game, you basically mean? Because obviously De Bruyne and Rodri are going to do it in like different ways.
They're going to do it in different ways, but you know when you just see a game that maybe is a bit bitty at the start, and then somebody just clicks and goes, you know what, fuck this, I'm going to run this game. And then they just run that game.
Yeah.
De Bruyne, fantastic at it. Rodri, fantastic at it. Different ways, but they're fantastic at it. Obviously, both of those players have been... Rodri's only been missing through suspension, but when you look at them without De Bruyne and without Rodri, it's like, okay, you start to see the real qualities. Like you start to see their squad in the cold light of day, that all of these players who look kind of great when they're put beside these unbelievable players... But once you take those unbelievable players out, you're thinking, okay, how good are you actually in terms of, if you're left to do this on your own, if this is your show and you're told just run it, are you actually good enough to do it? And I think a lot of City players aren't, maybe they could be good enough, but they're not good enough yet, or they're just not good enough. And I think maybe that's one of the downsides to having players like De Bruyne, who is just so otherworldly incredible, that you kind of get a little bit like you're used to playing second fiddle and you play off him. Yeah. So... I don't know, but for me...
But Foden's like a starting quality 10 for like almost every other side in the league.
I just don't
like if you ask me like who's better, like Szoboszlai and like Odegaard do more stuff deep in possession. But if you ask me like, I guess, I don't know, it's difficult because they don't play quite the same position.
Yeah.
But like Foden, I don't think is like not... He's not far off that level
I think he is the one player in that squad who is... The way, like, he's the next generation of this. Like, he can be that 100%. I don't think he is currently. Like, that's why I said he's still a little bit immature.
Mm.
But if you were to ask me who would I prefer to, or who would I have more confidence in just dominating a game, Odegaard or Foden, I would always choose Odegaard. He's just older. Yeah, he's just more cultured. He's further along in his career.
Well, and he's more of a deep dropping player. And like when we're imagining this kind of guy who takes charge of the game, we're
quite
sort
hard
of
to do
imagining
it so high up. Yeah.
You're kind of imagining Steven Gerrard types. And De Bruyne is very Steven Gerrard-y.
It's like a two-way midfielder.
Yeah, and like Odegaard like is that as well in terms of grabbing the ball in his own third and taking it all the way to the other. But I mean, but my issue really is just that I think they've gradually, and again, I talked about this at the time, like they've gradually cut members from the squad who I think made them less predictable. Like they used to have a bunch of guys who would get shots from wide areas. They used to have, like, you know, Jesus, they had Sterling, they had Mahrez. And these guys were all people who would just, like, win you a few games a season. And I think now they don't really have them. Like, they've got wingers. They've got useful wingers. But they've all tended towards the kind of creator side of things, or the ball mover side of things. And away from the shot-getting side of things. So, look, it's not exact, because obviously, you know, De Bruyne is injured, but Haaland's there. But I was looking at the last time they had Mahrez, Jesus and Sterling. And that year, this was 2 years ago, I think, Mahrez had 3.4 shots a game, Jesus had 3 shots a game, and Sterling had 2.3 shots a game. Whereas Grealish, Doku and Foden are at 2.5, 2.7, 2.2. So that's down on all of those guys. They're down... Yeah. What, 0.7, 0.5, 0.1. That's a really significant drop. That's a lot of shots down. And, you know, now they take about 70% of their shots from the middle. That's not a problem. Loads of teams do that. Previously, it was about 66%. Well, again, I'm not saying that this is the entire reason, but when I watch them, I do just think there is one really reliable goal scorer here. When De Bruyne is fit, he gets a decent number of goals. Foden gets a decent number of goals. Alvarez gets a decent number of goals. Mm. But they don't tend to get the goals that are like, they win you 6 out of 10 games. Like, Haaland is kind of that guy. And they're more reliant on Haaland, I think, than they ever were on, say, Aguero. And Aguero was also phenomenal, world-class, amazing, arguably the best player in the league or in the conversation when he was playing for them. But he would be injured and they'd bring in Jesus and they were just as good.
Yeah.
Whereas now it just feels like, no, our plan is that we get high-quality shots for Haaland. And if Haaland's not there, it's like, well, we try and get high-quality shots for Alvarez or someone else. But they're not quite as good at that. And that is a serious problem. That's a serious problem. Yeah, and I think they've got these wingers, you know, like this argument's been made 100 times, but it's like Pep Guardiola's career can be you can look at it through the lens of Pep teams get counterattacked and Pep hates being counterattacked, and everything he's ever done in his whole career has been like, how do I solve counterattacking? You know, you think about especially those Real Madrid defeats when he was in charge of Bayern Munich. And those are really signal moments in his career. And also, you know, the Mourinho years when they were playing in El Clasico. But everything he's done has been kind of about how do we control games to stop this happening? And to some degree, it's resulted in them getting more and more conservative to the point that last season we were seeing Rodri plus 5 centre-backs. Like, that's fucking bananas. Well, there is a cost that comes with that, which is that you need hyper elite players or you need magical tactics to continue to operate at world-class attacking levels while weighting your personnel so heavily towards defending transitions. When they've got injuries, I don't think they can do it. When somebody's out of form, I don't think they can do it. When the teams in the league are improving, both in coaching and personnel, I don't think they can do it. So look, I don't know. If we come right down to it, what is your feeling on where this is going to go? Like, I know we always look like twats if we predict something.
Yeah. Well, so this season, I suppose the team main predictions are Premier League and Champions League.
Yeah.
It's difficult because my brain, from all of the data we have had over the past 5-6 seasons, all of the experience, the lived experiences, the trauma that this city reign has caused me, it's really difficult to look past them just because De Bruyne is coming back. Haaland scored a ridiculous amount of goals last year and has the ability to do that. Rodri's incredible. They have so many other players that are still incredible. But I think if a season they're not going to win the league, it's going to be this season. So I could comfortably see them finish third.
Oh my God.
Maybe second. I genuinely think one of Liverpool or Arsenal will just fucking go balls in on the Premier League. And from this stage, right, what we are, they've got what? They've played 17. So there's 21 games left this season. Mm. Quite a lot. But at the point of recording. But I would back one of Liverpool or Arsenal to just go balls in on the rest of the season, on the Premier League. Fuck off anything else. Doesn't matter. And Arsenal are currently 5 points ahead. Liverpool are 4 points ahead. Liverpool and Arsenal play each other on the 23rd, which I think is the day this podcast goes out. I think they'll play each other the night this podcast goes out. Which, if Arsenal win that, Arsenal are then 4 points ahead of Liverpool.
Well, City need to hope that they draw, basically.
Sure, right. But if Arsenal win that game, Arsenal 4 points ahead of Liverpool, they'll be 5 points, maybe 8 points, between 5 and 8 points ahead of City with 20 games to play. It might seem naive, and it probably is, because City have proven last season that they can just go into hyperdrive. But if Arsenal are going to win the league, I think this is it's hard to say it's a better chance than last year because they were fucking miles ahead last year. But I would see Arsenal potentially winning the league, and then Liverpool City is a kind of toss-up, second, third.
Mm.
But I mean, Champions League, should we do Premier League first and then move to Champions League?
Well, I think the two are related, you know, because
it depends what you choose, right, basically.
To me, in the Champions League, you know, like I know that Mike Goodman and Michael Cady were talking about this recently, but they basically said City and Arsenal are the two best teams in the Champions League.
Mm.
And that's basically true. Like, I think that's pretty much the case, especially because of their control of games and Arsenal's attack being not incredible, but their defense being amazing is actually very good for, you know, knockout competition.
Yeah, yeah. It's much easier if you just don't concede. Like, if you don't concede a lot of goals, football becomes quite a lot simpler.
especially because you look at the teams and you're like, who has a totally irresistible attack this year? Obviously, any team can get hot and put a couple of worldies past you and you lose. But yeah. Like, there aren't many teams that are truly irresistible in attack, including City. But, you know, City, by the time we're getting to the knockout stages, they should have everyone back fit. Certainly, they should have De Bruyne and Haaland.
Yeah.
And that's probably enough. In the league, my issue is that, yes, 21 games is a lot. But right now, Arsenal are playing better. And Arsenal only need to maintain that level for a bit longer. Like, if Arsenal maintain plus 1.1 expected goal difference per 90 and City jump up to like 1.3 at some stage, let's assume that happens, that at the end of the season City are, you know, the best team in the league by expected goal difference. Well, if City do that immediately, then they're probably okay. Mm-hmm. Or if Arsenal drop back immediately, they're probably okay. But if it takes 10 games for Arsenal to come back and for City to go up, suddenly we're in trouble because that difference is not big enough over that number of games to kind of reel them in. Now, I'm not saying that I think Arsenal are necessarily going to win the league because, you know, like you say, they go away to Anfield this weekend. But for City, it's not enough for Arsenal to lose at Anfield. Arsenal lose at Anfield and City can say, well, by the stats, we're marginally better than Liverpool right now. But also, Liverpool can just decide to, like, fuck off the Europa League and just play, like, a B team. Yeah. They don't care. And Liverpool, if Liverpool win against Arsenal, then Arsenal would be, let's assume, 2 points ahead of City, which is still not great, given that, like, statistically, they're still better than City. Yeah. Arsenal would be 2 points ahead of City, and Liverpool would be further ahead, because I can't do the maths off the top of my head. But they'd be, you know, 2 points ahead of Arsenal, I guess. So they'd still be four up on City with stats basically as good as theirs. Like, I mean, this is the problem for Manchester City now. When you're behind two sides, you don't just need to be the better team and you don't just need shit to happen to one side. You need shit to happen to two sides and you need and to be the better team.
Yeah.
So it, you're just multiplying the difficulty. So I still would be sort of surprised if by the end of the season we don't look at the league and say Manchester City had the best expected goal difference. To me, the only path to that not happening is Arsenal are just better than I think and they just walk away with it. Liverpool are not going to win the league with the best expected goal difference. I think Liverpool, if they win the league, will still be, if you look at the kind of the stats, they'll be the third best time.
But also if, say, De Bruyne comes back and gets injured again, that would be a large reason as to why City might not finish with the best expected goal difference in the league.
Yeah,
like,
I mean,
they need De Bruyne and Haaland on the pitch for that.
Yeah, or they just, you know, they take a bit longer to come back, or like I say, Arsenal just stay a bit hotter, a bit longer. Like, that's totally possible. So City not winning the league looks like either Liverpool getting super hot, but I already think Liverpool are fairly hot. It looks like Arsenal basically just like proving to us all that this is what they really are and just continuing to motor. Like, if they were to get a draw at Anfield and just continue to like squeeze out results against everybody else in the league, like, Arsenal could just sort of walk away with the league. I don't put money on that because I'm a pessimist and I'm an Arsenal fan. But I just think that come the end of the season, if Man City are kind of within a small margin of Liverpool and Arsenal, when it comes to expected goal difference, they won't have won the league. They basically need to get way, way, way better and for those teams probably to get worse rapidly. Whereas in the Champions League, I still think they are probably the best side overall. You know, Arsenal are the better side right now, but not overall, maybe.
And also with the two legs as well, through that knockout system, it's kind of tough. City over two legs, I think, is much, much tougher than
and
City
Arsenal
in the
have
league.
The experience. City rather have the experience. Arsenal, I guess Arsenal have got like Jorginho and Havertz for whatever that counts for. But like City now do have the experience. This is a good Real Madrid side, but it's certainly not vintage. This Bayern Munich side could end up being amazing, but currently I think there are question marks.
Yeah.
Barcelona could be amazing, but I don't think they are. And Newcastle are out. PSG are pretty good, but I still think big weaknesses, work in progress. Like, Napoli could be great, but I don't think they will be under Mazzarri. So you look at them and you're just kind of like, yeah, like, this feels like...
Who else is there?
They're, you know, maybe Inter, but you look at it and you're like, there are probably four sides in this. Arsenal, City, Bayern, Real Madrid. Those to me are probably the teams in it. And I would say that City are at their best, the best of those sides. So, and they're more likely to be at their best when it comes to crunch time. But
yeah,
I don't know, man, we're in uncharted territory and it would be pretty amazing if at the end of the season there's a champion other than other than City. Because if Liverpool do it with this squad
versus the squad they had 3 seasons ago, 4 seasons ago,
I honestly think it would be a staggering managerial achievement. I mean, it would have required some luck, but it would be a staggering managerial achievement by Klopp if they do it. If Arsenal win the league this season, then you'd be like, yeah, I mean, they're pretty good last season, and then they added like Declan Rice.
£100 million on a midfielder,
Fair enough, the money they spent to win the league worked out.
But still probably like a season or two ahead of schedule. So like, credit where credit's due.
Yeah, but where City go from there is interesting, because if Pep's scheduled to leave in 2025 and they were to finish second or third this year, and like, you know, deservedly so.
If like a decline, if the zenith had been reached, and we were on the downfall, he leaves then, really, surely. I was still surprised that he stayed this long. Obviously, I presume like the treble and the Champions League was a big monkey on the back.
Yeah.
That now obviously isn't. So yeah, it's like if this is a trend that City are now just like leveling off a little bit into just a very good team, as opposed to the best team by far and away in the league. Yeah, I think Pep's time could be limited.
Okay, City dispense with that brings us on to the burn book. Pete, do you want to start? One, and two, shall we go positive or negative to begin with?
Okay, yeah, I'm happy to start. And
okay,
given that it's Christmas, maybe let's go positive, right? You know, a time of resolutions, maybe we should be more positive. Side note, fucking hate resolutions in general.
Yeah, I don't do that.
You're an adult. Just do. You don't need a new year. You don't need like the passing of a year to allow you to be better at something. You can just try and be better at it.
You can decide to do something now.
Yeah.
Yeah. You don't need to start your diet on Monday. You can shut the fridge.
You have control over your life. You don't need to wait till January 1st. Right. So I love the way we started positive. I tried to start positive. Within seconds, it went negative.
And two white guys as well being like, you can control your life. Like, you can literally do what you want. It's like, yeah, great. Thanks, everyone. Great.
Okay. So what I am taking out of the burn book, something that I really enjoyed this week that I found again, is a special water cup.
Oh my good God.
So there is this water cup in my house that I forgot existed. It was right at the back of a cupboard. And you're a big water guy, so you might agree with this. This might be something
big water guy.
Hydrated boy. But water from certain vessels tastes different. Some significantly better than others.
Great.
So this cup is, I don't know where it came from. I think it's Jess got it somewhere, but it's like hard plastic, kind of like a McDonald's large drink, but it's hard plastic and it's clear. It's got a screw on top, and then there's a hole in it with a like fixed plastic straw.
Sure.
Which is plastic. It's like really, 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 well, it's not like really heavy duty, but it's like substantial. It's not flimsy at all. I don't know what it is about this cup, but everything just tastes better in it. Like I've been putting my hydration sachets in it it's got the little straw. Obviously the straw is like fixed position, so it doesn't move. Like it moves up and down, but it doesn't like move laterally. It's not flapping about in there.
No.
All your liquid's sealed in because it's screwed. It's got a screw top. And I remember I used to use it for protein shakes a couple of years ago and revolutionized them as well. And then it's just sat at the back of the cupboard for like probably 2 years now, and I found it again when I was looking for something. I was like, oh my god, and now it's living on my nightstand. Because
do you know where it's from? Do you know?
No, it's
like
unbranded. It's just like kind of slightly bluish. It's clear, but it's got like a blue tint to it. Mm-hmm. But it's largely just clear plastic, unbranded. No, I think Jess probably knows where she got it from, but no idea. I kind of like the mystery. I kind of like it found me. I didn't find it.
Yeah. It's like it washed up, like on a seashore. It had like a gin in it.
It just, you know, it's like the universe just thought that, you know what? It's Christmas coming up. You're going to be drinking a lot of alcohol, more so than usual. Maybe you need a greater incentive to be more hydrated.
Oh, divine providence.
Here it is. We're giving you your special cup back. But I am a big, big believer that certain receptacles, certain vessels completely change the experience of drinking.
Mm.
So water out of a glass, terrible. Awful. Unless it's a plastic glass.
Or when you get You know, if you go to a hotel and there's like a nice glass carafe with a matching glass that's kind of on the top of it. You know what I mean? When you get like an amber glass carafe and there's a glass with it, then I'm like,
oh, as in like the stopper is the glass. So you turn it. I know what you mean, but I do disagree.
That adds a bit of fun to it,
It adds pageantry to it, but I don't feel. I feel like I know I'm still drinking out of a glass. However, beer out of plastic, awful.
Yeah, terrible.
So
I'm not an American.
Yeah, I'm not at a sports event.
I don't drink beer. I don't get fired.
Yeah, so the experience of beverage consumption is largely or heavily contingent on the actual receptacle. And I'm really happy that I refound this random little cup. When I say cup, it probably fits. It's probably 500 mils. Like, it's a good size. It's a good size.
You want a minimum 500 mils, I think, for water.
Yeah. Well, otherwise, it's not even worth the effort, right?
Yeah, you're just like, you fill it up once and you're just like, fuck this. This is too much work. I'll just be dehydrated.
Yeah.
But like, no, I agree. I agree very strongly on this. Like, because, you know, one, I'm a water boy. But two, the last couple of times I've got a G&T, I've been able to watch them as they make it when they're doing it in front of me. And both times, as a result, I've been reminded to say, don't give
normal
it to
glass,
me
please.
in the goblet. I said last time, I was like, can you just give it to me in a normal glass? And he was like, what do you mean by a normal glass? And I was like a fucking glass that you'd put a Coke in for a child, like a glass with a flat bottom. And afterwards I was like, they all have flat bottoms, but you know what I fucking mean. Like,
if
I don't
somebody asked you for like a fucking double whiskey and Coke, you would not give it to them in a goblet. I want the glass that comes in.
If somebody walked in and they were like, somebody outside is like, they've got heat stroke, can you give me a glass of water? Give me the fucking glass that you would put it in. Like, don't tit about
with a goblet of fucking life-saving water.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I've given you a sherry glass of water. Fuck off. Like, we're not at Hogwarts. Give me a normal glass for a normal boy. Like, that's all I want.
Class.
But anyway. Yeah, exactly. It's just like, oh, did fucking Professor Snape whip up this water for me? Get out of here. Okay, the thing I'm taking out of the burn book, I also feel is something that you're on board with, which is my Birkenstock Bostons, Pete.
Mm.
Because I've had these, I don't know, for probably like a year now or something, like a while.
Yeah.
And I was never really getting enough use out of them. You know, around the house, I just walk around in socks, or if it's warmer, I walk around in bare feet. And like, if it's raining outside, I've got some EVA Birks, you know, like just the plastic sandals slip on. You know, if I'm going out the front door, I just put on my shoes. Like, it's not a big deal. But since being in the new house, my Birks turned up quite early in the unpacking process. And I was like, I don't know why, but I just started putting them on. And now I wear them around the house. I wouldn't say most of the time, but at least half of the time. I just put them on to trundle around. And it's fucking great. I was like, they're so comfortable. I'm actually getting use out of them. When I look at them, even like yesterday, I was like, I'm fucking freezing. And because the boiler like decided to die, but I was wearing.
That's exactly what you wanted in your house.
Oh, it's just like fucking inevitable, isn't it? It's just like
at Christmas time as well, famously warm time of year.
I've had more. You know, I've been fucked harder by boilers than I have by any human I've ever met. But like, I found. But I was literally I caught sight of myself in the mirror, and I was wearing a pair of like brown Nike joggers. I was wearing like a mint green t-shirt. Over that I was wearing a quilted gilet because I was just like, fuck, I'm cold, and grabbed the nearest thing, but I didn't want to wear a jumper. And so I was like, Christ, this is like a deranged outfit. But on the bottom of it, I was wearing my taupe Birks, and I was just like, it's kind of a fit now because I'm wearing these Birks.
Absolutely.
But you know, you walk onto parquet floor, it's not cold because you're wearing your Birks. But when you're on carpet, they're not dirty, they're not destroying it, because I don't wear them outside, really.
They're
my tabbies. I have done, but it's been really wet recently, so I try not to, really, because I'm just like, I like them being my indoor shoes. When people wear them outside, it feels like people making a point. It's like, I've got friends who I will meet up with and they will arrive wearing Crocs or whatever. But I'm just like, this is a bridge too far for me. The idea of wearing beatniks, Birks, Crocs, any of this shit, like tabbies, anything like this outside as a real pair of shoes, I'm like, this is just a bit too far. Like, the world isn't your sitting room. You're not a fucking nurse. Like, just wear some normal shoes, like a big boy.
So, I'm on just the other side of that bridge.
Okay.
I'm fine with wearing them outside, but
I'm not. You're allowed to do it. I just wouldn't do it.
It needs to be one, a very appropriate event, and two, it needs to like really work with the outfit.
What's an appropriate event? Like a cookout?
I mean, I went to the pub in them the other day.
Okay. How close to you is the pub?
4 minute walk.
That's fine.
But
I wore them round the corner to a friend's barbecue.
Sure.
It was 100 yards away.
But I do think I might, like, there's a world, if they really work with a fit, that I would wear them in the, like, the office.
Oh, no,
It would be a question. It would be a question. But like, I have a pair of green ones, thyme green. And they only arrived a month ago. So I'm still
Green ones.
I'm still finding my way around them. But do you know ones I've got my eye on? And I'm hoping they go in January sale.
Are these the like brownie cinnamon ones?
Cord
ones.
They've just brought out a cord line. So the standard kind of basic. But that's why I'm thinking, like, if they get down to like 80 in say like January sales, I can probably stomach that.
But then I'll just do some beatniks, you know, because I quite like beatniks as well as a bit more of a sort of streetwear twist on the
Boston. Patrick, I am an absolute slut for corduroy then.
So am I. I just bought a corduroy sofa.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I bought a corduroy sofa. I bought the baby some corduroys that match Emma's corduroys. I'm a big corduroy guy. Like, I love corduroy.
So good.
And corduroy, I mean, I might have to look them up. They do so incredible. Emma just bought the brown, like cinnamon brown Birks. Yeah. I don't remember what the colorway is actually called.
I think the color of the cord ones that I like might be a similar color to Emma's ones. But I'm just thinking, like, with like slightly wider leg Dickies, corduroy Birkenstocks might slap.
Oof. Okay.
And if I have two pairs of Birkenstocks, I absolutely need to wear at least one of them outside.
Just
from a point of like value.
The colorways aren't great.
I like the normal brownie one, like the yellowy brown one.
Yeah, it's fine. But like, and they've got a darker brown. Let me see. Oh no, fucking blue. There are two different kinds of blue. No. Nah, they fucked this, Pete. No, this isn't good.
I've only looked at the
I like the tan one. I like the tan one, but instead of this, but this red one, this rusty red one, in my view, it's just coral, really. It should actually be like rusty red, because then that you wear that with your service works trousers, you wear that with your Dickies, your painter pants, your carpenter pants. Yeah, I'm on board. Look, if you get these,
your entire wardrobe like tonally works with a rusty red.
Yeah, it does. Like, I went out the other day, I was wearing like the rusty red service work trousers, and I was wearing, I've got a rusty red North Face puffer, and I was like, I accidentally look like I'm wearing a suit. Like, but
one's like
the most oversized workwear kind of shit.
A puffer jacket, yeah.
Yeah, like, what's it called? Gorp core, kind of like.
Oh, one of those ones, yeah.
Yeah, so but pretty much my wardrobe is tending towards just like all earth tones with some green. But look, I agree they're cool. Yeah. I just think they could add another color to the range. And sure. I look at Beatniks and Good News, you know Good News?
Right?
They're like a
good
London
news.
Shoe brand. Like, they have a sort of Beatnik variation, which is also cool. But anyway, it was just nice that basically I'd kind of got to the point where I was like, oh, was this a fucking waste of money? Like, did I just like buy these and hope I'd wear them and actually I don't wear them? And then it was kind of gratifying that I was just like, no, they're great, I just needed the right context to wear them in.
So I'm very happy that you've reached this stage. I do feel though that the more you wear them indoors, the more like assimilated they'll come into your life, and the more likely you'll wear them outside.
That's very true, but like,
you also start seeing yourself being like, this is kind of a fit, but you're just at home, and it'll get to a stage where I think you'll feel that more people should enjoy the fit.
I very rarely think that I've got
a fit
on.
Okay, I'm going to wear them outside to this barbecue, and then from the barbecue it goes to the shops, from the shops it goes to, oh, I'm just going 15 minutes down the road. Very slippery. It's a very stylish but slippery slope.
Then you're going to a wedding, you know.
You say that right. One of my old colleagues, one of my old colleagues, her fiance is a guy who cuts my hair, but they went to a wedding in Cornwall in summer, and he wore Birks with a suit, and it fucking worked.
Peter.
It fucking worked.
Nah, come on. I've just sent you something in the chat that is just like a shoe for you to look at in terrible, terrible content for this audio podcast, but like, they're pretty sick.
Those are punchy.
Yeah, those are punchy. Wear those to a fucking wedding, bro.
If you want to know what we're talking about, Google Good News, Frank, Teddy. They're a bold number.
But, you know, cozy season.
Cozy season, yes. Yes.
Cozy definitely. Season with a couple of cozy boys. Anyway, should we move on to what we're putting in the burn book?
Okay.
What are you putting in the burn book this week?
So what I'm going to put in the burn book this week is the idea that because something's more expensive means that it's better.
Sure.
So this is born out of two things. The first thing is fillet steak.
Okay.
Fillet steak is, point for point, will be by far the most expensive steak on any menu. And it is like maybe fourth best steak available in terms of cuts.
Ooh.
Because fillet steak
I don't disagree.
It's really small and really lean. But for me, most of the flavour, most of the enjoyment that comes from a steak comes from the rendered fat. Or at least the combination of good tender meat plus rendered fat. Which is why like a ribeye or a sirloin, for me, far superior and significantly cheaper per pint. You get bigger steak and you'll enjoy it more.
Picanha as well. Picanha is really good.
However, with fillet steak, I feel like it's like an affluent thing. It's like I can spend the money on it, so I'm going to get it and tell everybody that it's the best thing. Or I think it's the best thing because, you know, it's the most expensive thing, so it must be the best. And I can afford it, so I'm going to do it. And it's going to be like I'm going to look cool doing it because I'm ordering the most expensive thing on the menu. So I hate that. I don't subscribe to that. I don't remember the last time I ordered a fillet steak. I definitely have in my life, but I would say probably north of 10 years ago.
I've only ever really ordered it in like a, you know, when you get between two people, like a Chateaubriand, where you're like, this is basically a fillet steak, but like larger.
No, I mean, it depends.
The Chateaubriand is the whole tenderloin, right? And the fillet is a cut of the tenderloin.
I swear there is more fat on like a Chateaubriand. See, I've been deprived of Chateaubriands in my lifetime, given that for the last six and so many years, I've been dating someone who doesn't eat meat.
We should go for a Chateaubriand.
And the £90 Chateaubriand for two for one could be the move. It could be the move. But it's a bold move.
It is the move. It's like you have steak one day and you have steak sandwiches the next day.
Well, you take.
No, it's not good at our
arse. No. Yeah. In my head, I'm just like, you're about to witness a show here. I'm ordering the Chateaubriand and nothing else.
And, like Elvis.
Yeah. But yeah, so fillet steak was one of the things that kind of triggered me for that. The other thing is Rolex, the brand Rolex. Now, I think Rolexes are fine.
Yeah.
I think they're kind of boring, at least the modern ones. I think the vintage ones can be really cool, but the modern ones are kind of just like copy and paste, but maybe with a different face. Like the range in terms of aesthetic, they all look pretty similar. And the company has just been marketed incredibly, incredibly well. If you go to 100 people and say, name a luxury watch brand, I would say over 90%, over 80% of those people, the first name out of their mouth would be Rolex.
And I would say James Bond thing as well, isn't it? And shit. Like
they
it's
have
like
Rolexes?
The right they did for a while. They have then they had Omegas during the Craig era. And I prefer Omega.
I love Omegas. But Rolex have kind of become synonymous with luxury watch. Like they
affluence,
are the gatekeeper of the luxury watch world. And if you ask a random person, name a luxury watch brand, I would be shocked if they didn't name Rolex, at least within the first three goes. And the actual fact is, though, but the actual fact is, though, if you look at...
I have a counter argument to where this is going, though.
Okay, well, where it's going with it was that if you're actually talking about genuine luxury watch brands, there are so many more that are, in my opinion, significantly better than Rolex. So like Jaeger LeCoultre, for one.
Which are more expensive than Rolex.
Yeah, but they don't have.
I agree. I prefer a Jaeger LeCoultre. I prefer a Patek Philippe. Like to
Patek
I love Patek
slaps.
I love Patek Philippe, but they're fucking way more expensive.
You can pick them up on auction for about the same price. The thing is, it feels like when you buy a Rolex,
you've been looking at late night auctions, haven't you?
I have, like, Bonhams in particular. Specifically, I'm looking for a 1968 Omega Seamaster Deville. Specifically in 18 karat gold.
Okay. In 18 karat gold, 1968 Omega. Oh, fucking hell.
Omega Seamaster Deville.
I saw an Omega the other day that had a linen face.
Yeah,
it described
so I might
it
have
as
seen
a
the same
linen
one.
Face. And I was like, oh.
It's so nice.
It was, oh, this I is think, vintage Seamaster DeVille. Okay, I don't know if this is what you're talking about, but it's very, very nice. It's very beautiful. This is 950 quid, Pete.
Okay, so that I think that might be.
I'm just saying that's like so, you know so that's think, like a few months of Patreon.
So
yeah, a lot of
basically
months of
Patreon. I think on auction you can get them for somewhere between like 702 grand, depending on condition, etc. But yeah, I've been looking at a lot of watch auctions recently. But for I don't know, for me Rolex is like even if you're in a 10 grand mark, say you want watches up to £10,000. A Rolex will probably run you somewhere around that. If you had £10,000 for an Omega watch or I don't know what else. Like, I feel that money could go to a much, much better watch that doesn't
you
just
could get
have...
Like you get like a Cartier Tank that's like top of the range for that.
Yeah, I think
which
it'd be struggling.
Think is a nice,
Cartier Tank
which
is
a nice,
stunning.
You can get a really nice Cartier Tank for that. You can. For
yeah,
under
you can,
10K.
Yeah, for 10 grand,
you definitely
sure, yeah.
can.
Yeah.
I would never spend that on a watch. I just can't bring myself to do it. There's just something baked into me.
I think I could.
I just have like a poverty mentality inside me that just like lets me would just prevent me doing that. I'd encourage Emma to do it instead. I'm trying to encourage her to buy some Prada loafers at the moment.
Without like convincing, I could go up to maybe like 4 with limited convincing. But anything north of that, I'd be like, I'm gonna have to really girl math this.
Yeah. You'd have to be like, and then I had like ramen 2 days this week, and so now I can spend 7K on a watch.
But yeah, for okay, so say obviously, yeah, Patek Philippe, Jaeger LeCoultre are amazing watches, but fair point, they are significantly more expensive than the majority of Rolex's catalog.
But you're right, Rolex would not be as highly regarded if people didn't know it was expensive and associated with luxury, like for what
and
it is.
I just feel anything Omega is better than Rolex. Even Tudor, which is a Rolex sister company. I think they share factories. Yeah. I prefer Tudor because also there's more range in their like offerings. Like they do the kind of Rolex style ones, you know, the classic Oyster Perpetual style, similar but Tudor. But they also do a lot more sleeker, elegant watches and slightly dressier watches. Jess got me one for my 30th, actually. They're just more range. They're just nicer. I do like vintage Rolexes, but the modern ones are just like, they're like a, it's like a badge for a twat, like a twat club.
The closest you could get, I think, to like convincing me with a Rolex is, you know, the real kind of like vaporwave, like Dayglow blue ones from the 80s, the kind of like Miami Vice type ones. Like you could convince me if I was just like, I'm going to move to the Caribbean. I'm going to dress like Colin Farrell in Miami Vice, which means I'm going to have a mustache and I'm going to look kind of sweaty, but like hot as fuck.
Yeah.
Like
hot in every sense of the word.
Yeah. Oh, mate. He's so hot in that film. I was actually rewatching it today and I was just like, this is, it's like him and Gong Li having a sex scene. And I was like, I need a minute. If the temperature above 5 degrees outside, I'd be in trouble here.
You had to take your gilet off.
The lightheadedness came back instantly. I was just like, woof. But you know, you're wearing a linen suit. You're in Havana, like drinking mojitos with Gong Li. And you're wearing a watch that has like a powder blue face. Like it's disgusting, but in a way that I kind of love.
There's an absolutely gorgeous Tiffany collaboration with a slightly blue, like Tiffany blue face. I can't remember the actual brand from it. I've been looking at a lot of watches recently. but I'm so reluctant to ever try Rolex because it just seems like it's a fucking... It just seems like you'll look like a try-hard, even if you're not trying hard. Even if you just like the watch. And also, all of the Rolexes I like are just slightly different or maybe worse versions of the Omega I'm looking for.
I think that's probably fair.
Which I can get for a fraction of the price.
I think this is a good one. I've never really been a fan of Rolexes. I've never really understood it. I now just want to keep looking at watches, to be honest with you. Like, just find something with like a pink dial or something absolutely bananas. So maybe at some point we can just like kickstart that. We can be like, that could be a level on the Patreon. Like buy
or watches.
Yeah, like buy Pete a wedding watch.
Yeah.
Oh my God, there's a Mont Blanc one with a salmon dial. Fucking hell. Okay, I actually need to stop this. This is going to become a real problem for me. Fortunately, I can't afford any of these right now. So we're actually in perfectly safe territory. Okay. What I'm putting in a way, it's somewhat related. No, it's not. It's not at all. But it is about luxury brands, which is, I think, we've reached a disturbing point with knockoffs. Like, knockoffs are fucking everywhere now. And for all of the fact that the generation younger than us, like Zoomers, like talk about ethical consumption, it's weird to me that when it comes to consuming knockoffs, they are way worse than our generation and generation before. Now,
are they? I didn't know.
I think so. If you go on Instagram, you will be advertised things that are clearly knockoffs. And specifically, what I'm thinking of here are the knockoffs of Issey Miyake, the On Plisse, Pleats Please trousers. Okay? The classic trousers pioneered by Issey Miyake, RIP. Amazing pleated polyester trousers. They are 100% polyester, but they are like, they're revolutionary. The fact that they retain their pleats no matter what you do to them is like quite remarkable. Sorry, I just need to bookmark a watch that I've seen on eBay.
I'm also I'm also in the chat. I'm typing out watches I think that you should look at.
Okay, I appreciate that.
I haven't said
Salmon
it yet.
Dial, man. Okay, but I literally get adverts all the time for things where I'm like, this is a knockoff of Issey Miyake's pleated trousers. It's clearly a knockoff. He designed this, he invented this. It is a knockoff of it. The fact that you haven't like broken into his factory and stolen the blueprint doesn't mean that it's not a knockoff. And in the 90s, which was a terrible era, but in the 90s, it was considered extremely gauche and bad taste to wear knockoffs. And that was mostly about status. That was mostly about you don't want to be caught wearing a knockoff or with a knockoff bag or whatever it was. It's like Sex and the City kind of stuff. However, the general principle of not wearing knockoffs is correct because people deserve to get paid for the stuff that they invent. And I think part of it is with clothes, everyone's got it into their minds that clothes, because you can get clothes so cheaply from Primark and Amazon and like H&M, that clothes therefore are always really cheap to manufacture. And that whenever you buy, you know, a pair of jeans for like 80 quid, that like 60 quid of that is just markup and they could sell you those jeans for 25 quid. And that is a fiction. That is a lie you're telling yourself. For jeans to be able to be sold that cheaply, they have to be made of shit and they will wear through really quickly. But good stuff made from natural fibers, made to last, is generally worth the money you pay for it. You can find breakdowns of like why high-end suits cost so much, why high-end jeans cost so much, why it costs more to have a pair of shoes made in Portugal than just something you've bought from Amazon, which could be made like God knows where in whatever conditions. Like, there are good reasons to do this. Fabric costs a certain amount.
As soon as you pick up something, you can feel it if it's good or bad.
There's a guy I read something from who was he was on one of the menswear forums on Reddit, and like they apparently did like a ranking every year where they voted who was the best dressed man on the forum, and he won like a couple of years running. And he said, I thrift most of my clothes, and the way that I cut down time in thrift stores is I will walk along and run my hand along the rack, and only when I feel something nice will I stop and look at the garment. And I tried it a couple of times and I was like, it is kind of true. You just feel the stuff that's plasticky and shit, and you feel the stuff that's like wool or cotton or linen or whatever it might be. But anyway, there's this belief that clothes don't cost much, that they shouldn't cost much, and therefore if anyone's charging a lot for them, then they are fucking you. And I think as part of a result of that, people feel like they're being Robin Hood when they buy a knockoff, because they're like, well, you know, Issey Miyake's just trying to gouge us by selling us this, or I don't know, who's, you know, Boston's, like Birkenstocks Boston's are another example of it. Like, why are Birkenstocks charging so much for this? We can get knockoff versions of these off Amazon. Oh, I bought the viral Amazon knockoff Birkenstock Boston's. Oh, yeah. Oh, you know, like, here's my review.
Yeah,
all this shit. And I'm just kind of like, no, knockoffs are bad. People deserve to be paid for the stuff they invent. And if they charge too much for you to buy it, if you cannot afford to buy real Issey Miyake's, and I include myself in the group of people who cannot afford to buy real Issey Miyake's, you don't get to have them. That's how that works. You don't get to have them. You don't get to just say, oh, well, I'll buy a knockoff one and that's okay. No, you should feel ashamed. When you walk around in your knockoff Issey Miyake en plissé trousers, you should feel bad about it. Because Issey Miyake fucking invented that, and he deserves to be paid for it. In the same way, I think we've basically got to a position as well where people think that design isn't worth anything, or they think the only thing that matters is like labor or something, except when it comes to them, of course. So like, this is why you get people constantly asked, you know, like graphic designers getting messages from people saying, will you do this for exposure? Like, it'll be really good exposure for you. And they'll say, it will only take you an hour or two to do. So like, it's not that much work you're donating. No, that's not how it works. When you hire a graphic designer, you're not paying them for how long it takes them to do the work. They are not a plumber who has an hourly rate. Like, you pay them a quote for the work, and that's because their ability to do that work is based on their expertise. It's based on the years they've spent developing their craft. If I sat down and spent 6 hours like designing a logo for a company, and then fucking, you know, Picasso sat down and did it for 2 hours, whose would be worth more? It's fucking stupid. Like, this idea that like, oh, well, you know, it's easy for you to do, therefore it doesn't cost much. I just think there's this idea that like, creating stuff, intellectual property is worthless. I think that you see this as well in the AI thing.
Specific in design.
And I just think like, it's really fucking tragic. And when you buy something online, and maybe you don't know that it's like knockoff Issey Miyake, but when you buy something online, if you do know that it's a knockoff, well, you just shouldn't buy it in the first place. Especially because I don't think that it is what you actually want to see in the world. Like, there are people, actually overwhelmingly black women, like all over Twitter, who design clothes and have their designs ripped off constantly by Shein, by H&M, you know, like by big brands. It is relentless. You see it everywhere. Like, if you go and follow Diet Prada or whatever on like Instagram, you see how small makers, people who are devoting time and enthusiasm to their craft, just get squeezed out by big brands. And it's fucking depressing. And ask yourself, would you rather be in an ecosystem where you buy your clothes either from super expensive tiny brands which constantly go out of business and you have to find a new one, or from Boohoo, Shein, H&M? Would you rather be in that environment where you have to do one of those two things? Or would you rather be somewhere like Japan, for example, where it is much more affordable for small makers to run their businesses because they are given tax breaks to do so, because the cost of living is cheaper, like because all these things are geared towards a specialist market and people who appreciate like well-made things.
And there's so many great Japanese brands as well, like clothing brand.
Exactly. And I'm not saying it like it's perfect in Japan, like it really isn't, but small makers can survive in Japan and they don't get squeezed out in this way. And I just think it's fucking demoralizing when I go on Instagram and it's like, oh, you liked... Clearly, it knows that I liked somebody's Instagram post recently where they were wearing Issey Miyake trousers. And now it's advertising. I think there's one that's called like Prévu or something, like, or some shit like this. And I'm just like, this is fucking knockoff. Like, this is a fucking knockoff. This should be like buying a Rolex, you know, a Rolex watch that says like Holex on it or something. Like, this should not be acceptable. So anyway, I'm sorry to go on about this, but it's been really pissing me off recently, and I just do not understand why we've decided to allow this to happen. I mean, it's partially Amazon, Alibaba, like all the big kind of companies that can drop ship stuff, but it's making for a worse world for everybody, for consumers, for creators, for everybody. And I just don't like it, and I think people should stop kind of like lying to themselves and telling themselves that it's okay to buy something that is a knockoff, but also because they can't afford the real one.
It's a good point that you said that, like, it's not even clandestine anymore. It used to be clandestine. It used to be kind of like you bought it like on the street or in like some secret thing or whatever, whereas now they're just overtly, like, openly doing it. I always get served these adverts for fragrance dupes.
Yeah,
like the whole advert's like somebody on the street being like, what are your favorite fragrances? And they name like these really expensive fragrances. And then it's like, well, I've got a thing that smells just like that for 20 quid.
Yeah. And you're like, well, you didn't invent a thing and it happens to smell exactly like, you know, Kirk Jean or like fucking, I don't know, like Atelier Cologne or whatever it might be. Like, you've literally spent ages figuring out something, how you can replicate this and sell it for like 30 quid a bottle. Fuck off. Fuck that. That's bullshit.
Agreed.
Okay, that brings us to the end of our public episode for this week. Obviously, if you're a subscriber, you can head over to Patreon and get access to our other episode. If you subscribe at Patreon for $6 a month, then you get access to 2 extra episodes a month. This month, I kind of misspoke on Twitter and said that you'd be getting all the episodes this month. That's not quite true, but that was never going to be true because of Christmas. But we will come back in January and make it up to you. We really appreciate all the sign-ups recently. It's been great, and it's been great to have people sign up for a full year as well. Remember as well that you can get your money's worth by submitting questions to us. Like, recently, we haven't been having that many questions come in, and if there's something that you want answered, if you want to know who your team should sign in January, if you want to know, you know, should Man United be targeting this person to run their recruitment or whatever, send us those questions and we will try and answer them. There are people who've had multiple questions answered on this podcast, and the reason is they ask. They ask nicely. So send in your questions and maybe you'll hear us answer them next time. But thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you either on the paid side or in the new year. Bye.